This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
In some ways, the gorillas are, you know, they're one of these, you know, flagstone species. So there's that certain appeal. And I think part of their sort of bigger importance is not only because their relationship to us gives them kind of a special status, but because of that special status, they also have the ability to protect the ecosystems and the other animals that they share ecosystems with.
In 1988, a Hollywood movie called Gorillas in the Mist depicted the work of the noted primatologist Diane Fossey and brought well-warranted attention to the plight of the mountain gorilla. In the intervening years, the story of how the mountain gorilla has been saved from extinction has been a prominent narrative for the animal conservation movement. But we haven't heard much lately about the mountain gorilla. And what of its close relative, the lowland gorilla, which is much more numerous than its mountain brethren and is facing its own threats to survival? This week on Sea Change Radio, we learn about the state of the world's gorilla population from Chris Whittier, a professor of veterinary medicine at Tufts University and a veterinary medical officer at the Smithsonian. We'll get a glimpse into the different challenges that both mountain and lowland gorillas are up against and come away with a better understanding of why it's of vital importance that we save these magnificent cousins in the mist. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by my old friend Chris Whittier. He is a professor at the Tufts School of Veterinary Medicine, as well as a veterinary medical officer at the Smithsonian. Chris, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for inviting me today.
So first, why don't you tell us a little bit about the project you've been working on in Gabon?
So in Gabon, I've been doing a little bit of work, mostly through the continuing work that I'm doing for the Smithsonian. So we are partners through the Smithsonian with a consortium of different organizations, including the WCS, which is the Wildlife Conservation Society, the University of California at Davis, Metabiota, and the EcoHealth Alliance. And we are funded from the U.S. Agency for International Development to be doing basically global wildlife disease surveillance work, trying to essentially catalog unknown viruses from wildlife populations in the hope that we can catalog and find diseases before they emerge and before they threaten human populations. So I've been working, Smithsonian has a long-term field site in Gabon where we've been doing basically biodiversity monitoring in partnership with the Shell Oil Company, who has a number of oil fields that they work on in Gabon. And so we've been partnered with them for a number of years doing biodiversity research at the couple of sites that they're involved with. And through this partnership that I mentioned at the beginning that is funded by USAID, we've had a couple of opportunities to do some field surveillance. And so the last summer in 2012, I led a team doing, essentially we were capturing small animals, mostly rats and mice, live trapping them, collecting blood samples, releasing them back into the wild and collecting samples from them while we were handling them, anesthetizing them, collecting blood, saliva, urine, fecal samples, and trying to look for new viruses. And we're just starting to get some of the results back from that work.
So it's really a confluence of human-borne infectious disease work with veterinary expertise to try to know more about pandemic threats. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a nice way of summarizing it. This sort of falls into this kind of growing area or discipline or field, however you want to look at it, that we refer to in a number of different ways. One of them being this concept of One Health, where we sort of recognize that human health can't be separated from animal health, and neither of those can really be separated from environmental health. So, you know, looking at examples of where typically health problems and usually infectious disease, but not necessarily infectious disease, are posing an increasing threat to human populations but it's all tied to, you know, animal disease problems and environmental change.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Professor of Veterinary Medicine at Tufts University, Chris Whittier. Chris, you were formerly a veterinarian with Gorilla Doctors and still work for the Smithsonian in primate research. Can you tell us a little bit more about your work in Africa with the gorillas? And I couldn't help but notice the difference in populations between mountain gorillas and lowland gorillas. Maybe you can explain a little bit more about that for us.
Yeah, so most people don't realize that we now recognize gorillas as two different species of animals, or two different species of gorillas. So there are gorillas that come from the eastern part of Africa. So you could sort of draw a line down the middle of equatorial Africa, sort of through the middle of Congo or DRC. And on the eastern side of that, you have what we refer to as eastern gorillas. And on the western side, you have what we refer to as western gorillas. So two different species. In the east, there are a couple of different subspecies, but generally between the different subspecies, they're relatively small populations. So the best known of any of the wild gorilla populations are the mountain gorillas, who are actually either the smallest or the second smallest, depending on whether you divide the mountain gorillas into two different groups. But there are right now somewhere in the neighborhood of about 700 of those gorillas left in two different populations.
700?
700, yep.
Wow. And is that mostly because of poaching or resource depletion?
It's a little bit of both. The mountain gorillas are sort of adapted and evolved in a fairly unique habitat that, you know, part of where they get their name of, you know, as mountain gorillas is that they live, you know, essentially in the mountains. So in the couple places where they remain, they have a very, you know, restricted habitat that's, you know, the upper elevations of the volcanic mountains in Rwanda, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. So there's been kind of massive historical encroachment on their habitat, and it's, you know, it's hard to say how far they may have ranged, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But, you know, even when the mountain gorillas were first discovered, quote unquote, and at the beginning of the 19th or the 20th century, there were, you know, probably not very different from the numbers that there are today.
Are these mountain gorillas the ones of Diane Fossey fame, or did she study lowland gorillas?
No, the mountain gorillas are the ones that Diane Fossey studied, and that's part of why they are known. So the mountain gorillas, generally when most people think of gorillas and we get a mental image of gorillas in our mind, it is mountain gorillas, mostly from the work of Diane Fossey and the other people that have followed in her footsteps and a lot of the work that goes on in that region. You know, David Attenborough and most of the, just about any documentary that you'll see on television about gorillas until the past few years has focused on the mountain gorillas. And so they're the ones that are what we call habituated, which means that people have been, you know, through years of work and people approaching them when they were totally wild, you know, individual gorillas or groups of gorillas were totally wild. Most of those 700 gorillas now are what we would call habituated, which means that they tolerate people going into the forest every day and getting very close to them. And so those people are a mix of behavioral researchers as well as tourists. So gorilla tourism is actually very big business particularly in Rwanda and Uganda, and to a lesser extent in Congo because of the civil problems in Congo.
This tourism, just mountain gorillas, this population of under 1,000 gorillas.
Yeah, so in the two different parks there, I'm not sure of the exact numbers right now, but when I left Rwanda in 2006, there were five groups that were being visited on the Rwandan side. So that means that five different groups of tourists, usually eight people at a time, plus a couple of guides, would go and visit each of those five groups of gorillas every day. It's pretty much book solid every day of the year. And I think the fees right now are about, I think it's $750 for your 1 hour visit as a tourist. And there are now at least eight groups that are being visited just in Rwanda. So it's a, you know, multi-million dollar tourism industry for those couple of countries.
And I interrupted you when you were talking, you were about to move on to comparing that to the lowland gorilla population, which is pretty hardy.
Yeah. So the lowland, it gets a bit confusing because they're actually, technically, there are lowland gorillas in both the eastern and the western species. So on the eastern, what we used to refer to, or we still sometimes refer to as these eastern lowland gorillas, are on the eastern side. So these are the closest relatives of the mountain gorillas. Their numbers, nobody really has a very good idea of what their populations are like. It's the best estimates are that it's probably somewhere between 5,000 and maybe as many as 20,000. They're in very scattered areas. They're all in the Congo, in very poorly protected areas where there's a lot of poaching. Their numbers are probably going down very rapidly, and they are arguably probably some of the most endangered. So that's one kind of lowland gorillas that we usually, or that have historically been referred to as eastern lowland, although we now tend to refer to them as Grauer's gorillas, which is their scientific name based on the first person to document them, i.e. shoot one and bring it back to Europe. So those are the one type of the lowland gorillas. And then the other, the western lowland gorillas, which is basically all of those gorillas on the western side, their numbers also are not really good estimates of their total population, but it's probably at least 100,000. But their numbers are actually going down much more rapidly than any of the other populations, mostly because of hunting and habitat loss. So they're spread across a huge area, some of them in protected national parks, but many of them outside of national parks. And one of the big differences in that Western Africa, there's a lot of, most of the cultures in Western and Central Africa eat gorillas as well as most other wildlife. So the gorillas in Western Africa and these Western lowland gorillas are actually very, very much threatened by the bushmeat trade, and they're being eaten while their forests are being cut down. So they're right now considered to be even more endangered than the mountain gorillas, even though their population numbers are much higher.
Hmm. But I imagine that most of the gorillas that we see in zoos are these lowland gorillas, correct?
Yeah. So just about they're the exception. I believe there's only one of them left. There might be two of these eastern lowland gorillas that are in a zoo in Belgium, but all the other gorillas that are in the world, in zoos in the world, at least legally, are all western lowland gorillas.
So that's one of the reasons why there's this expensive ecotourist trade to go view these mountain gorillas, because the only way you can see them is by going up into the hills of Rwanda.
That's part of it. It's actually a fairly interesting and complicated sociology, or you know, that goes into the reasons behind the tourism industry there. So I think that's obviously a big part of it, is the fact that they are at least more rare in terms of numbers of their total populations. But I think the fact that they are also kind of the first ones to be studied, and that they were made fairly famous by Diane Fossey, you know, as an American researcher, as well as the coverage that they received in National Geographic, is another part of the equation. And the other big part of the equation is that there's been a vibrant tourism industry in sort of Eastern Africa. If you think of safaring in Kenya and Tanzania, you know, that's an industry that goes back, you know, at least 100 years. So there's been very much more of a culture of tourism in that part of Africa that Rwanda and Uganda benefit from. That's not true when you get into, you know, Republic of Congo and Gabon and Central African Republic and the areas where the Western lowland gorillas live.
This one is for all the bouncers. Big, big monkey man.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Chris Whittier. He's a professor of veterinary medicine at Tufts University. Chris, why is this important beyond just the gorilla? What does it mean for all of us when we study an endangered species like the gorilla?
Well, I mean, in some ways, the situation with the gorillas, whether we're talking about the, you know, any of the populations, in some ways, the gorillas are, you know, they're one of these, you know, flagstone species or charismatic megavertebrates, you know, the different classifications, which basically means that they have some kind of an appeal. And, you know, gorillas are something that we can relate to because they're physically like us. They're obviously genetically related to us. They're about our size. You know, we can look them in the face and understand expressions and all those kinds of things. So there's that certain appeal. And I think part of their sort of bigger importance is not only because their relationship to us gives them kind of a special status, but because of that special status, they also have the ability to protect the ecosystems and the other animals that they share ecosystems with. So, for example, if there weren't mountain gorillas in the places where they are in Rwanda, Uganda, and Democratic Republic of Congo, all of those forests would have been cut down a long time ago for the firewood, you know, for bamboo and to try to raise crops at least as high up as you can go into those altitudes. So the fact that the gorillas are there means that those forests have been protected and that they, you know, they continue to, the governments continue to protect those areas and keep rangers there and keep those as national parks. And a lot of other animals, you know, benefit from that as well as the people. And there are, you know, interesting dynamics with the mountain gorillas in terms of those mountains and what happens with the rainfall, and that the, those parks essentially serve as a sponge that, you know, absorbs rainfall during the rainy parts of the year and then slowly distributes that water to the surrounding areas over the course of the year. So there are a lot of benefits, you know, unseen benefits to the human populations in those areas as well that might not be the same if the gorillas weren't there to kind of be a reason to protect them. So that's a part of it.
Well, it sounds like this one small population of mountain gorillas is pretty stable. Just from, if people go to gorilladoctors.org, they can see some of the work that you and your colleagues have done there. And I don't know how many doctors on hand, but there's like, these are well-treated gorillas. They obviously have a lot of interface with humans, including medical care. So it seems like that population is okay, just that smaller population. Is there a chance for it to flourish again and to come back to the levels that once were?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, that yes, the fact that those, I mean, essentially those gorillas and those populations have more or less private medical care. So there are, you know, a number of veterinarians employed by the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project in all three of those countries that are kind of constantly looking after them, along with all of the eyes that are on them from the researchers and the tourist guys and everybody that's there to help monitor them. And those two populations of mountain gorillas are actually the only populations of great apes in the whole world who are increasing in number. And part of that, the veterinary component of that is a big reason why those population numbers are going up. And some of my colleagues published a paper a few years ago that trying to kind of quantify the impact of the veterinary work. And I believe that the long and short of that was that if there hadn't been a veterinary contribution to their protection, along with the, you know, the anti-poaching patrols and everything else that goes into it, then that population would probably at best be, you know, stable where it was a few years ago and not growing like it is now. The part of the issue with the, you know, with that population, those populations continuing to grow, is that the area that they're in is not going to grow, or at least it's not going to grow very much. The park in on the Rwandan side where the mountain gorillas are and the Virungas is the surrounding human population is actually as dense a human population as you'd find in most large metropolitan areas in the U.S. You know, in terms of number of, you know, hundreds of people per square kilometer, you know, those numbers. So it's almost impossible to imagine, at least in you know, the next couple hundred years, of those areas ever being, you know, reclaimed and becoming any kind of a forest. And there are some slow efforts to try to create buffer zones and to enlarge some areas around those parks. But it's hard to conceive, you know, if you went there and stood in, you know, a kilometer from the park, you know, in Rwanda or Uganda, you're basically being in the middle of a field, you know, usually a potato field without any trees, you know, within a couple hundred meters. So it's hard to think about those ever being any kind of a gorilla habitat. So there is this potential issue on the horizon of, you know, how, if the population continues to grow, where are all those gorillas going to go? And there are already starting to be, you know, funny things that are happening in those populations with really large, not, you know, groups getting into really incredible numbers. When I left, there was one gorilla group that had gotten up to more than 70 individuals in one group, which is kind of astronomical to think about when a typical gorilla family is kind of 15 to 20, at least for the mountain gorillas. So it's, you know, those things are starting to, there's a potential of there basically being too many gorillas in that habitat.
So can they be reintroduced to other regions ultimately?
Well, that's part of the, I mean, part of the conundrum is that the answer to that is probably not, because they're, you know, at least in the Virungas, those gorillas have adapted to a very unique habitat, and there isn't any other habitat like it. And even the differences between the two mountain gorilla populations, the population at Bwindi that's just in Uganda is in a slightly different habitat. And so the nearest, you know, sort of similar habitats that you have where you could even think about putting any gorillas like that are all theoretically already occupied by their, you know, their cousins, the eastern lowland gorillas. And unfortunately, those places are all, you know, where part of the ongoing, you know, civil and political strife in eastern DRC is, you know, making those places pretty unsuitable to think about doing anything like that. So that's a big part of the problem. But and the other thing is nobody really knows, you know, even in the limited area where the mountain gorillas are currently, nobody really has any idea of what the maximum number of gorillas are that habitat can sustain. So it could be that it's, you know, that it's not in the foreseeable future that they would reach their carrying capacity in that habitat. So it all remains to be seen. But it will be interesting as the population numbers continue to grow. And, you know, it's not inconceivable that in our lifetimes there could start to be discussions about having to use, you know, some kind of, you know, population control in terms of, you know, different drugs to prevent fertilization in those wild gorilla populations.
And they can't even go to zoos?
There would never be any practical way of doing that. And there are a couple of mountain gorillas that have been confiscated from poaching activities in the past couple of years that are in a sanctuary in Africa. But there's general, mountain gorillas have never survived very well in captivity. And since there are none in captivity, I don't think anybody would ever want to start the precedent of establishing, you know, a population in captivity, because essentially you would have to have something close to the size of the wild population to have a sustainable captive population. And I think it's hard for me to imagine that ever happening.
But when you talk about population control, does that mean killing some gorillas?
No, I'm thinking more about, you know, basically the same sorts of things that we do in zoos in terms of, you know, reproductive implants so that females aren't, I mean, basically giving female gorillas the pill so that they're not fertile and not reproducing. And obviously that's another whole can of worms, and there are different implants that you can use often in wildlife as well as in zoo populations to prevent reproduction. So yeah, that's
pretty stunning to think about a species that has less than 1,000 of its kind, and then somehow having to limit the amount of babies they can have.
Yeah, and I think it's, and you know, I think it, in some ways, a lot of people would say it would be a nice problem to have that there were ever sort of, you know, too many mountain gorillas. So it's not, it's arguably probably not foreseeable.
But as you said, it's really a question of encroaching human activity, I imagine.
Exactly. And I think, and that's really the sort of the bottom line is that, you know, we could end up in this fantastic situation of having more gorillas than can live where they currently are. But the problem is that in all likelihood, we could never find another suitable space to put them in, because we've essentially cut it all down.
Take him home tonight. Is she really going out? To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Chris Whittier. He's a professor of veterinary medicine at Tufts University. I can understand now, after you explained a little bit more about the plight of the mountain gorilla, why these lowland gorillas are actually more endangered, as you said, even though their populations are in the couple hundred thousand. Is that correct?
Yeah. So that's a little bit of, you know, when I left the mountain gorilla work, a few years ago, you know, my feeling has been that there's a lot of attention, there are a lot of resources that are focused on the mountain gorillas, which is fantastic, and that, you know, we can only wish the same of other endangered species around the world. And part of what I had hoped to do when I left that work was to be able to take some of the experience and lessons that I'd learned and apply that to other populations. And I managed to get connected with some now very close friends of mine that have been working with the very few groups of Western lowland gorillas that are habituated, and trying to basically transpose some of the veterinary work that seems to be working with the mountain gorillas into these other populations. So just to kind of put this into context, you know, if you look at the 700 or 800 mountain gorillas, it's something like, you know, somewhere between 60% and 70% of those individual animals are habituated. So it's somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 500 of those mountain gorillas are habituated, meaning researcher tourists can go and see them on any given day. On the flip side of that is that with the, you know, say something like 100,000 Western lowland gorillas, they're actually probably less than 50 individual Western lowland gorillas that are habituated, that can be visited right on a daily basis. So there are a lot of theories about why this is the case, but it basically, for some reason, it's much more difficult to habituate these Western lowland gorillas and essentially get them to tolerate people being very close to them. And so because of that, there are only a few places that researchers working for a long time in really difficult conditions have been able to, you know, habituate a couple of groups. And one of those has been two groups have been in the Central African Republic. So that's where I've most recently been doing the veterinary work that I do with gorillas.
And the fact that they're spread out more, on one hand, it has allowed them to flourish to these numbers, but puts them at much greater risk because people like yourself and your colleagues can't really keep an eye on these gorillas and give them the TLC that the mountain gorillas are getting. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's a little bit of it. I mean, so a part of it is that the sort of big scale of where, you know, how distributed their overall population is. And then, you know, there are other sort of subtle factors to it in terms of why there aren't more habituated groups. And, you know, these Western gorillas basically live mostly in really flat habitats and forests that generally aren't as productive in terms of having gorilla food as the places where mountain gorillas live. So because of that, these Western gorillas tend to move a lot more. So they have bigger ranges. They move a lot more while they're there. And those are probably, contributing reasons to why they're so difficult to habituate. So, you know, because of that, they're also not as densely populated in any one area. So there aren't any places yet that have a large number of groups that are habituated. So there are these two groups in the Central African Republic. There are a couple more in the Republic of Congo. And then we know of some colleagues that have some groups that are sort of semi-habituated, you know, can't quite be reliably seen every single day, but can usually be found on most days back in Gabon.
He's a professor at Tufts University in veterinary medicine, Chris Whittier. Chris, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Auntie Ballas, The Specials, and Joe Jackson.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.